And with that, please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Dave N. from Port M. from Port Fishington Group, Philadelphia.
These lights get me every time I come here. How you guys doing? My name is Dave. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is April 23rd of 2004. I actually have several home groups. I'm a member of the Port Fishington Speakers Group that meets on Monday nights at 7:30. The format to that meeting is very similar to this one. It's also kind of like my claim to fame in AA. I'm going to tell this little story about this other group. I had a friend of mine that had a restaurant. She was a woman. And she started a big book study for women in a restaurant. It would happen to be like a block from my house. And my wife went. And I got wind one week that a gay guy was allowed into this meeting. I don't know. I just found that very offensive. So the next week I decided I'm going to go to this meeting. And even though it's a woman's meeting, and I went, it wasn't a meeting. It was just women getting together to study the big book. So I went in the next week with a big book and just sat down. And 2 weeks later, it became an Alcoholics Anonymous group. And meets Sunday mornings at 10 o'clock at Frankfurt and Norris, right over top of the Circle of Hope Church. And I'll get into the reason why in a little bit. But my life in Alcoholics Anonymous has changed dramatically over the last couple of years. And I just want to say, a meeting that reads a set-aside prayer at the beginning of the meeting is a place where I'm going to feel really comfortable. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit tonight. That prayer absolutely changed my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it kind of allowed me to breathe. And I don't know why, but it seemed like I became, there was like a point in my sobriety where I became very rigid, and I became very kind of like lockstep Nazi-ish about this thing. And one thing I've learned over the years being in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we're trying to open people up to the idea of love and compassion. And what I've learned about love is there's nothing rigid about it. It's very flexible and it's very understanding. And that prayer helped me to get past a kind of a really rough spot in my life. It's been an honor to sponsor men and women in this program, and it's just as much of an honor to have a man that I'm accountable to on a daily basis. That's my sponsor. I think both of those things are equally as important. If there's anyone here, if you sat around Alcoholics Anonymous long enough, you've watched people, just as many people blow right out of the top of Alcoholics Anonymous as slide out the back door. For me, in my experience, it was very important for me to be very active in sponsorship, but also have somebody in front of me as well. And I'll try to kind of talk about that, too, because I think it's really important. I wasn't born in Philly. I was born outside of a little town called Lynnwood, New Jersey, right outside of Ocean City. A mother and a father that loved each other very much. I have an older brother who's 4 years older than me. My father, without going into the long, hairy story, was an orphan. His father was an alcoholic, and his mom died of tuberculosis. And when my grandmother died, my grandfather was like, I can't deal with these kids, and he just left. And it was my dad and his two brothers just basically in a house for like a week with no care. And that's, you know, they got found and put in an orphanage. My mom was the only woman my father was ever with. Very devoted man, very religious, very, you know, taught me everything that you're supposed to be taught as a kid. And I don't know what this is about. I don't know if there's different classes of alcoholics. I'm not that smart. But if there was, I would think that I'm in a class that I'm going to call the George Costanza alcoholic. What I mean by that is I'm very neurotic. And I've been that way since I was a kid. Very awkward socially. I'm constantly in my head about stuff. And as a kid, prior to finding alcohol, I didn't have an answer for that. It was just my head would just go. And I'm in like school. I'm like 6 years old, and I'm thinking about the next day at school, who I'm going to see, what they're going to say, what I'm going to say back to them. If they say this, I'll say that. Then they'll say this, then I'll say that. Then they'll be ashamed of themselves, and I'll be a big shot. That's always, I'm always John Wayne in my head. Never plays out that way, because the next day comes, and then I run into one of you guys, and you say something that I didn't have a plan for, because you don't know how to follow a script. And I ain't got a plan for it, so I would say something that really had no bearing on the conversation, or it made no sense, no coherence at all. And you would just look at me with that, like, what was that? And then you would walk away. And then I would walk away. But the difference between you and me is, as I'm walking away, I got a voice in my head telling me I don't even deserve to be around people. Now, what I learned at Alcoholics Anonymous is we have this thing here. We call it the committee. I'm sure a lot of us here know about the committee. The committee is that, depending on how sick or well you were at the time, it could be anywhere from 7 to 46 voices going on in your head. And if you pull up next to me at a light and you look over at me, I may look like a very mature, well-balanced individual who's on his way to work. But I can assure you I'm not alone in that car. There's quite a few other people there. My gym teacher from high school, my wife, her grandfather, who's been passed for 7 years, he's in the car. Just got a lot going on. But as a kid, I didn't know about that. Like now, because of the beauty of AA, I can kind of laugh at myself when I got that stuff going on, because it does happen. But as a kid, I didn't even know that existed. But I had it. And I thought, like, something was wrong with me. It just would eat me alive. One of the other symptoms of my malady is this constant need to compare myself to you and to find a way to be accepted by you. And that's kind of like played through my whole childhood, like how I interacted with people, and I was always trying to get people to like me, and I was always thinking like, all right, well, they're, and I don't know why I thought this way, but I would look at people and think in my mind, their dad's car is better than my dad's car. And that, in my mind, meant they were better than me. Now, I know the truth of that today, and that's just not the truth. But you couldn't tell me that when I was a kid. So I'm constantly doing this stuff. I'm constantly in my head, constantly worried about stuff. I'll tell this one story to kind of convey it to you, like how deep it went. I played football, as I'm sure a lot of us did as kids. I was not like the running back or the quarterback. I was the lineman. I was a guard. And, there are the guys that always got, like, grass in the top of their helmets. They're always, like, doing all the rough stuff, and they get dirty. But they never get any praise, and they never get, like, looked at. Like, oh, they're so great. They're a guard. You're just the guy that's blocking. That's it. So one day we're in practice, and the coach decides he's going to put in this new play. And over time, I've developed this kind of a resentment towards, like, the quarterback and the running back. And it was all around that kind of stuff. Like, they were always getting attention. They were always getting praised. I'm not getting nothing. So they start practicing this play. And I'm basically the guy right next to where the center is. So the quarterback gets the ball, and he puts it on the floor, like on the field. Like, it's a fumble, but it's not. It's all staged. Then I'm supposed to stop blocking, pick the ball up, and run around the end. And, I mean, it worked good in practice. But, like, all week long, I'm convinced in my head that they were just doing that to make me feel better. They're not really going to call the play. So here we are, big game, the last game of the year. Everybody's, like, the stands are full. All the families are there. It's all kinds of people. Fourth quarter, 2 minutes left. And they come running in. They always send another guy in with the play, and he comes in, and that's the play they call. I don't know if we've talked about this thing called fear yet, but Because it was all fun and games. Like, we practiced it and practiced. And I was like, yeah, man, that, you know. But they'll never call the play. And then they called it. And it worked perfectly. I went around, I picked the ball up. I ran around the end. Like, there was nobody within 20 yards of me. I'm running straight. Like, there's the goal line. Tripped on the 2-yard line. Game over. There's nothing worse in this world than public, you know, humiliation. And I know it wasn't this way, but in my mind's eye, when I think about that event from my childhood, I can visualize people literally standing, pointing, and laughing. Now, I don't think that's what really happened, but that's how tricky my mind can get. The reason I wanted to share that story with you guys is because that's basic. I can almost just tell you that story and then sit down, because that's my whole life. I sit, whether it was like coming up through high school and you know, all that stuff when I was drinking, or even in all my time in AA. I would come to AA, and I would sit and complain about something. Like, I need a job. I can't get a job. I can't find a job. And then all of a sudden, boom, I get a job. And then I don't know what to do with it because I'm scared. Now I get the job, and I don't know what to do with it. That little story encapsulates basically my entire life. That's how my childhood was. The age of 8... I had my first introduction to alcohol, and that was when the playing field of Dave's life shifted. What I realized this night when I drank and I was sitting on the dock with a bunch of other kids is that 4 Rolling Rock Pony bottles equals no fear. 4 Rolling Rock Pony bottles means I no longer am worried about what you're thinking about me. I'm no longer worried about what you're going to say to me. I'm no longer worried about what I'm going to say to you. I just said it. And here's the kicker. As I was saying it, I was kind of knowing that you were digging what I was saying. That may not sound like a big deal to anybody else in this room, but if you lived in my body for those first 8 years of my life, that's a really, really big deal. It just seemed to me to work for me. There was no experimenting. I wasn't like a kid that like drank through high school and just partied on the weekends. Like, I found something that worked. And it just went from there. Ended up in high school, long story short, without going into it. I was standing in front of a judge at the age of just about a month prior to my 16th birthday, and they sentenced me to juvenile life. In the interest of Alcoholics Anonymous' traditions, I will just basically say to you guys that I was engaged in selling non-AA conference-approved substances at my school. I got involved in doing that because I wanted you guys to think that I was that guy. Because, again, this goes back to me and my desire to be accepted and liked by you. And when I first got to high school, I saw these other kids that were accepted and liked by you, and that's what they were doing, so that's why I did it. I wasn't doing it because I wanted to, like, I was into that. I did it because I was trying to make a name for myself. I also had a cell phone. This was in 1989. I don't know if anybody remembers cell phones back then. They were... I mean, I thought I looked cool. The truth is, I looked like I was calling in troop reinforcements for an airstrike. But again, I had that phone because I wanted you to see me on that phone because I thought it was all connected in my mind. But long story short, my criminal career lasted about 9 months. I got sentenced to juvenile life, and that began this descent. And I want to take the opportunity, because I heard what Paul was saying in the opening. One of the biggest honors that I think I've experienced in almost 10 years that God has allowed me to be here happened for me about 3 months ago when I was asked by a friend of mine's mother to speak at her Al-Anon meeting. Now, don't get me wrong. I've been to a lot of AA meetings, and we like to sit in here and laugh and joke and have fun and tell funny stories about stuff that we did. And believe me when I tell you, I got plenty of that. However, I don't ever want to stand at a podium in Alcoholics Anonymous and ever mitigate or minimize the damage that my alcoholism caused my family. My father drank once in his life, on his wedding night. And I actually saw the picture with his glasses like this, sideways. He suffered from my alcoholism, and he never drank. And I don't ever want to minimize that. It really was. It was an honor, and I teared up. It was really touching. I went into it with a perception of what Al-Anon was, and I left it with my perception being shattered, because it really amazed me, like what happened in that meeting. But that was the beginning of my causing damage to my family. So I did this time. I got really, you got to learn things about jail life, and I figured out I'm pretty smart. I know how to write things. So I started being like kind of there was a lot of guys that were in there that didn't know how to write or read, or didn't have family that were coming to see him or advocate for him with judges. So I started like writing letters for people. And every time I would write a letter for somebody, I'd write one for myself and send it out, never thinking that my judge would ever read it, which he told me he did, but I know the truth. It meant one of his clerks read it. But one day they woke me up after about 14 months. It was about a month before my 17th birthday, and they said, "You got to go to court." So I went down in front of this judge, and he said, "I'm going to commute your sentence to a treatment center in Philadelphia, and you'll be released from that treatment center on your 18th birthday." And I didn't know it at the time, but that was basically like setting the stage for my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got to Philadelphia, go to this rehab, thank God for, they called it at the time a snafu. There was like a paperwork mix-up. And they said, "Well, look, it's Thursday, but we can't really bring you in until next Wednesday. We don't have a bed." Just so happened to be very convenient for me, because that same night at 7:30, the Grateful Dead was beginning a four-day run at the Philadelphia Spectrum. I was like, "Well, isn't this convenient?" And I had been off any mood of mine, ordering no alcohol, nothing, for like 14 months. But as soon as I was given the opportunity, I was right back in the mix. And went on a little run there. I came out of this run standing outside of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. How did I know it was an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting? Well, I came to, and I saw a bunch of old guys with gray hair with these white cups in their hand. Now, I've come to know later in my life, that's a clear sign that that's an AA. But what I heard that day was, "Come on in, the meeting's starting." I had no idea where I was. Turned out I was standing outside of a meeting called Life or Death at Torresdale and Blakiston Street in Philadelphia. Nobody felt it necessary to inform the new guy that the meeting was located over top of a gun range. Now, I'm not a Philly kid, so I'm sitting in this meeting and I'm kind of like really kind of getting my bearings a little bit. I'm beginning to realize there's gunshots. This can't be good. And I'm sure it brought a lot of humor to the old guys at the meeting, because I jumped and shook, and I think at one point maybe even tried to get under a table. But in that meeting, somebody showed me a small act of compassion that every chance I get, I'm going to tell that story. Because to me, people say, like, what is it that we have to offer each other? And I can tell this story and kind of convey that. There was a guy there named Bud R. And he's, a typical AA guy. He's got to have a nickname, right? So everybody called him Bud the Handyman. Bud saw the condition I was in. When they started that meeting, we came in from outside where it was raining. So I was wet, cold, and I don't know if this is like AA protocol for clubhouses, but they had the air conditioning on like 46. I swear the guy across from me had icicles in his mustache. It was insane. It was so cold in there. So I was like shaking, shivering a little bit. And he saw me from across the room, and he went and got me a cup of coffee, and he brought me a half a cup of coffee. Because he knew if he brought me a whole one, I would have spilled it all over myself. Now, my mother, who probably loved me more than anybody on the planet, I don't think she would have thought to do that. Not that she didn't love me. She just didn't have her own experience to relate to understand the condition that was in. On the other hand, Bud did. That's always a big deal to me. And sometimes when I think about it, I think it's not. But it blows me away when I think about it, you know. On an unrelated side note, I don't know if this aggravates anybody else as much as it does me. I almost... Bud won the lottery twice. Good, I'm glad. I thought I was the only one. I mean, I'm not talking he like hit a scratch off. He hit the lottery. Like, hit the lottery twice. It blows my mind when I think about it. So, that was my introduction to AA. I get into this rehab. I'm in the rehab from that day until my 18th birthday. I learned a lot about myself in there. It is not my job in Alcoholics Anonymous to take shots at anybody in the treatment industry. Those people gave me what they had. But my experience is it wasn't effective for me. I learned a lot about relapse. I learned a lot about prevention plans. I learned a lot about triggers, things that set me off. I learned a lot about negative emotions that might lead to something for a guy like me. I learned a lot about that stuff. But me not having a drink or not having any of that other stuff never treated this thing that I have on the inside. And in perfect AA fashion, about 3 months before I was leaving, I met her. She was the cashier at the Sunoco station at the corner of Rowan and Pine. We had a lot of romantic evenings behind the dumpster. And I want to say this because a lot of times we get caught up in AA about the damage we cause to our families. And I want to tell this little story because I caused damage in my family completely sober. On my 18th birthday, it's like a big graduation day at this rehab. You like, you know, it's a big production. You pick a song out. You know, they have like cake. You know, you give a little talk. And my father, who's very deeply related, and he didn't share this with me until I was sober about 6 years. He was driving up to see me graduate. And he was meditating in his car ride on the ride up about the story out of the Bible of the prodigal son. And how much my story mimicked that. You know, like I had just been out, you know, riotous living, whatever, and now he was coming to get his son and bring his son home. And so he comes up with my mom, who was very ill. And I stand on a chair and I give a little talk and I pick the Bob Dylan song. It was called I'll Remember You. It was from his Christian phase when he was wearing all that sequin stuff. And I got off that chair and I was walking out and I'll never forget it. Standing in, there's like a little roundabout outside of the bridge. And I'm standing with my father and my mom and this girl Jen, who was the Sunoco cashier. And I said, Mom and Dad, listen, I'm going to go with Jen. I'll catch up with you guys later. I was sober 15 months at the time. And I didn't realize until I sat down and had this conversation with my dad at 6 years sober how deep that wound cut for him. And I don't mean to stand up here and be controversial. I do believe that anybody that has the ability to get through a day without a drink of alcohol, if you lived your life anyway remotely similar to the way I lived my life, that in itself is a miracle. However, I don't ever want to diminish the damage that I caused my family. And the way that I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous is if all I ever think that I have to do in AA is not drink, the first person I should call to ask to make sure that that's true is my family. So I got out of there. I got involved in a... And I want to kind of talk about my experience in AA in two separate occasions. That time, came home from the bridge, was 18 years old, got involved in a clubhouse right close to my parents' house called the Stagecoach Group in Marmora. I don't care where it is that I'm speaking, somebody will come up to me after the meeting and talk about that place. It's a really is an amazing example because it's still there. It's moved about, 27 times, but it's still there. I went to 3 meetings a day. I got very involved in business, made a lot of money. My life externally got really good, probably the best it had ever been. I moved out of one place into another place, out of another place, ended up on 18th and St. Charles overlooking the ocean in Ocean City, where I could literally flick a cigarette butt into the ocean from my deck, watch the sunrise over the ocean. If you were to ask me when I was in the bridge at 16, what do you want your life to look like when you're 20 or 21? That was it. I got to make tie-dye t-shirts and sell them on the boardwalk, file the Grateful Dead around, sober, and remember the shows, which is kind of cool for me. I was really externally, things were going well. The problem is, this thing we call alcoholism and Alcoholics Anonymous is not an external thing. It's an internal thing. And it's tricky because I buy into a delusion that I think just about all of us have bought into at some time or another. The delusion is this, that I will somehow be able to treat this internal condition by fixing up my outside world. And I've done it a lot. I've done it rather recently. And I'm quite sure I'll do it again. But it's a lie. Because no matter how it, and then you start having to deal with the dichotomy of it being so good out here and so bad in here. That's disconcerting. And I was very active in AA, was going to meetings all the time, constantly involved in business meetings, which, by the way, if you're an untreated alcoholic, I wouldn't suggest it. 2 things I really think we do Untreated Alcoholics Anonymous, Untreated Alcoholics a disservice to in AA. One is business meetings, and the other is AA dances. There is nothing worse than the feeling of walking out of a church at about 11:30 at night when you got a little couple. And you know that sound? They're laughing and giggling off in the night. They're over here. And then there's another couple laughing and giggling walking off over here. And you're going back to the recovery house. Alone. And about the best plan you could come up with is maybe, just maybe, I could get up earlier than Paul tomorrow and beat him to the remote and have control of the TV. That's your big plan for the next day. I stayed sober for 4 years. And I don't mean to be controversial, and I'm pleased if somebody wants to come up after and argue with me. I'm all ears. But I only got what I got. This is my experience. So I was here 4 years. I didn't pick up a drink. I had no mood or mind-altering substances in those 4 years. I went to probably 1,300 meetings. And that's a conservative figure. And after 4 years of sobriety, I was crazier than I was when I got here. I was completely out of my mind. Basically, in 4 months, I completely trashed my entire life sober. Because enough's never enough for a guy like me. I got, and that girl from Sunoco became my fiance. Moved down the shore with me, But I don't know about anybody else, but when I get sick, one just ain't cutting it. And that's one of anything. Whether it's a car, a girl, a house, a job. I don't just get one job, I get 7. You know what I'm saying? Enough is never enough. So I decide I need to stray because I need to fill this hole that I got. So I do that. I think the Young Bucks today call that the side joint. Well, I can only share with you my own experience. That didn't work out too well for me. My girlfriend, my fiance found out she rolled The other chick really, it was all about excitement. So once the girl was gone, she was gone too. I was 21 years old. I was not a businessman. I was a kid. But I was renting a spot on the boardwalk from this guy who knew I didn't have certain licenses and certain tax ID numbers and certain things that you need to have for a business. And he also saw the amount of money I was making. So he basically extorted me right out of business. After like 3 months, I was like, I'm just basically spending all my time here and handing all my money to this guy. So I lost my business. Alcoholics Anonymous had become absolutely 100% untenable for me without a program. And I don't mean to take shots or anything like that, but this is just my experience. If you're going to try to do AA, I would suggest doing it with a program. Because Alcoholics Anonymous will drive you insane without it. I just couldn't take it. You know, I mean, after a while, it just, you have this internal dialogue going on. And you got to go to the meeting every night, and you got to put on that, I like to call it the AA game face. And you're standing outside, your mind's going a million miles an hour. How you doing? Fine. How you doing? Fine. How you doing? Fine. Doing good. And then you're sitting in these meetings and people are saying, if you didn't have a drink today, you're a winner. But after a while, my head started saying things to me. And this is what I would think after a while. That actually worked for me the first couple months, first year or two. But then I started having this thought. And I'd be sitting in a meeting and somebody would say that, if you didn't have a drink today, you're a winner. And my head would say, yeah, but what if you don't feel like one? Because that's how I started to feel. And then I started to play the AA rat race. And the way that works is I become so consumed with what God had so graciously given you that I lose touch and reality with what He had so graciously given to me. And you go into the meeting and you see the other guy that's just got the new car, he got the hot girlfriend, or I got to get that now. New sneakers, I got to do. You know, and that's all it became. It became this external race, which made me much sicker internally. So 4 years sober, sitting on my bed, everything's gone. Girl left, business gone. My mom died, my dog died, Jerry Garcia died, all in a row. May not sound like a big deal, but it was. I mean, that was my whole life. All this stuff just all happened at the same time. And you're going to hear profound things in AA. For my money, I heard the most profound thing I have ever heard before, since, after, ever, sitting in an Acts of Recovery in Barnegat, New Jersey about 7 years ago. This guy named Billy, and he said, you know, it's comical to me, and I'm paraphrasing, we watch people and we spend, everybody in AA, every meeting in AA, everybody asks at the beginning of the meeting, who's in their first 30 days? And then everybody attacks them. Everybody's looking for the guy in his first 30 days. He said the guy we should be looking for is the guy in his last 30. Now here's the problem with that. I was that guy at one time in my life. And one thing I can tell you is that as one of them guys who's in his last 30 days of AA, I can tell you that you don't know that you're one of those guys. That's the cunning, baffling, and powerful feature of alcoholism. But that's what happened to me. Drama hit, life problems showed up. I had nothing. There was no internal, I had no relationship with God. I had never opened a book. Everything was fellowship. There was never anything, and I can honestly say this, there was never something that I had done in those 4 years when nobody was looking. I had never engaged in recovery on that level. I never understood that there was something other than sitting at the clubhouse at 4 o'clock in the morning. I never got that. So I had this thought, I want to drink. And then I had another thought that said, if you go out drinking, Dave, you're going to lose everything you have. So I played the tape. You know that cute little saying you hear at a lot of meetings, keep it green, remember where you came from, play the tape, play it all the way through. I played it all the way to the end, man. My head said, you know what, Dave, you might not want to drink because you're going to lose everything you got left. And guess what? I drank anyway. And I'm going to make a really short story even shorter. That began 10 years of my life that I can't even put words to describe to you what it was like. I came out of that on April 23rd of 2004, sitting on a park bench, and we drove past it tonight on the ride up here. Sitting on a bench where it was like a bus stop. I was homeless, been homeless for 9 years. I went from 18th and St. Charles Place in Ocean City with all that money and all that stuff to an abandoned house at Ruth and Clearfield Street in Philadelphia in about 7 months. And I stayed there. I was, you know, I had about 17 different abandoned houses. The way that life works, you get into a house, you get situated, you set up shop, get yourself a couple milk crates, maybe an old mattress, and you just go. You get as many blankets as you can until one day you show up and it's boarded up. And then you got to start all over again. Let me find another one. And I did that about 17 times. So on April 23rd of 2004, I'm sitting on this bench. I had a little problem. I was a panhandler by trade. Problem with panhandling is you got to get to that corner early. Otherwise, somebody else might show up and like sell papers or flowers or something. And if you're trying to beg for change on a corner where somebody else is actually doing something, people are going to not give it to you. They're going to be like, get a hustle like him. Well, I kind of had a problem with oversleeping. And I slept in like a tent. And I don't want to give you guys the impression that I was like some woodsman, because I wasn't. I had a tent with the whole deal, with the tarp and the stakes and all that, and that was just too much for me. I would just get a stick, put it in the middle and climb it. So I'm sitting on this bench, and in my mind, this is a big deal. This is like CVS and Rite Aid. This is like a big corporate struggle. Because there's this Russian guy that keeps showing up on my corner before I get there, screwing up my whole gig here. And in my mind, this is like a big struggle. It's like a big corporate thing. And the truth is, it's an immigrant and a homeless guy fighting over a corner that isn't even theirs. My musing was interrupted by it was really part of me that's like embarrassed and humiliated by this part of my story. I would love to sit up here and tell you guys that I was like John Derringer and I went out in a blaze of glory and shoot out with the cops. And I got locked up by a park ranger. And I mean, he had a little patch, Smokey the Bear thing on the side of his, the whole bit. And I had absolutely no idea that that was going to be the beginning of this thing we call a new life. I had no idea. If I had anything to do with the date of my sobriety, somebody else would be speaking tonight. I am not a guy that ever made a decision to stop. Decisions were always made for me, usually by somebody that was holding a key to a cell. I don't have interventions that involve loving family members. I have interventions that involve the Philadelphia prison system. That's how I stop. So this guy asked me my name. I gave him a fake name. You know, he found out everything about me. He had, I don't know if he had like some kind of supercomputer in his dune buggy. But, he knew like every alias I had ever given. Up to and including when I was 16, I got locked up in the woods under the influence of some mushrooms. And I told him my name was Pete Moss. He even knew that name. So that computer was pretty intense. And like I said, I had no idea that was going to be the introduction to this thing we call a new life. No idea. I end up in jail. I'm in a cell by myself. I'd like to tell you I'm in that cell by myself because I own the jail, because I'm good like that, because I know all the guards. But the truth is, I was in that cell by myself because if they put me with anybody else, they would have killed me. My hygiene game was a little weak. I'm just going to leave it at that. But when they stripped me down, the clothes that I was wearing literally had to be removed from me. They were like stuck. So they were like, yeah, we don't need to be putting this dude with anybody. But in that cell, I had that moment. And I heard a voice. And it was almost like somebody was in the cell with me, but I was completely alone. And the voice said, Dave, the fight's over. Now, I had no idea what that was. Not a clue. But every time I get asked to do this in Alcoholics Anonymous, I get the privilege to be able to reflect on my life from that day till this one. And every time without fail, I can report to you guys that from that day till this one, with a certainty in my heart, I can tell you, I have not remotely considered going back to living the way that I used to live. What I personally believe that is the loving hand of God just cutting something completely out of me. I did nothing to deserve that. At that moment when that happened to me, I didn't even meet somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous again yet. I had yet to meet my sponsor. I had yet to take any action. So we have this thing in AA we call grace. And if you look that word up in the dictionary, it means an unmerited gift or a blessing. That's what happened to me. And I believe that in my heart. That day, that wasn't a park ranger coming to like get me out of there because I was living in a field that they didn't want me living in. That was God doing his little magical work in the background, connecting the dots to get my attention. I ended up leaving that jail in about 2.5 months, and I went to a Spanish recovery house. I don't speak Spanish. But suffice it to say, I have little tolerance for people that call me. And you know the new guys that call you from the recovery house, you know them calls? Hey, Dave, I think Bill ate my tuna sandwich last night. Yeah, try morning meditation in Spanish for 6 months, you jerk off. Bang. Very little tolerance for that stuff. It's my belief that you'll get sober wherever you end up. There's a place where I'm from in Philly called The Last Stop that is appropriately named. And out of all the facilities that I've been involved in the time that I've been sober, I can't think of one that has more of a success rate. And you don't even sleep on a bed when you get there. You sleep on a board. So the idea that I have to be in a good, you know, place or whatever, I just don't believe that. I think a lot of it comes down to the individual. I went through the 12 steps out of the big book in a month and a half with a guy that knew what he was talking about. It's not my job tonight to take anybody here through the 12 steps. That's your sponsor's job. My belief is that the message of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is best carried across the kitchen table or at a coffee shop or sitting in a car. It's not really meant to be carried from a podium. I had moments with this guy, and I want to be really clear about this, because sometimes when I sit in AA, sometimes the impression is left that like, yo, man, just go through these 12 steps, you'll never have another problem. Everything's going to be gold. And that has not been my experience. I have made an unbelievable amount of ridiculous mistakes. And there have been times in my life, sober, where like, I could be in a room full of people and people are gushing over how great of a guy I am. But meanwhile, my personal life is a mess. It's just in shambles. I've had experiences in sobriety, you know, where I could go almost anywhere on the East Coast in any city and not have to worry about staying anywhere because I knew people all over the place. And then at 7 years sober, this thing called a son comes into the picture. And I was somebody, I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous that was like super active. Like it was nothing. We'd be sitting at a coffee shop at like 2 p.m. and be like, hey, what do you think about going to Richmond, Virginia tonight for that 8 o'clock meeting? Okay. And you just get in a car and go. Go to York every other week. Go to Maryland every Thursday night. Go all, you know, and just always doing stuff like that. And life got good. I got enrolled in college. Things started to look up. Started to get this kind of a daily routine. Alcoholics Anonymous has a, there's a lot of stuff that we do in AA that everybody sees. The speaking, the sponsoring, talking to new guys at the meeting, all that kind of stuff. But the most important part of Alcoholics Anonymous is the stuff that nobody sees. And convert, you know, coincidentally for me, they also happen to be the things that I always had the hardest time with. It was easy to stand at a podium and be an all-star for an hour. But it was really hard to do that in my life. When the chips were down for a lot of years of my sobriety, I can honestly stand here tonight with no shame and say, you know what? There was a lot of days that went by that if you were to ask me, hey, did you pray today? Yeah. I didn't. And that's just me being as honest as I can. And over time, as I continue to do that, here comes alcoholism again, rearing its ugly head. And I could never see the connection in that. So completely blindsided, out of the blue one day, it was in the middle of Game 4 of the 2009 World Series. My wife is sitting in the other room, and she's sitting on the step, and she's crying. And I'm like, it's all right, they're going to come back. You know, it was like right in the middle of when Cole Hamels lost the Game 4. I'm like, it's all right, it's going to be okay. And I look down, and there's a pregnancy test in her hand. And I'm like, oh, God, you know. Now, I had no idea. Like, I talked about it, and I have friends that had kids in recovery. But you don't realize, like, how much that's going to change your life until it actually happens. That meant no more 2 a.m. fifth steps with the crazy new guy screaming. You know what I'm saying? That meant no more of that. That meant no more Richmond, Virginia trips in the middle of the week. All that, it just kind of shifted everything for me. And I don't know, about 8 months. She was 8 months pregnant. And we were sitting on the couch. It was like that, you know, that time when you're, every little thing, is that the one, you know? Like, is this when we're going to go? She was kicking my ass in Yahtzee, like she always does. And my phone rings. And it was my friend Claire. And Claire was calling me from a conference in Sacramento, California. And as she was talking to me, I could hear all this noise in the background and the joy of it and the happiness, you know, that sound of a convention. And I talked to her for a couple minutes and I hung up and I went back to my wife. And then my phone rang again. And it was a buddy of mine, Matt, calling me from Florida. He was at some spaghetti dinner with Chris Raymer. They didn't sound as happy, but you could still hear as many people in the background. Same thing. And I remember hanging the phone up with him, and then like, not even a minute later, the phone rang again. It was my buddy Drew calling from a young people's conference in Vermont. And as humiliating as it is for me to stand up here and say this tonight, I got to be honest with you, when I hung that phone up, even though I'm about to experience probably the greatest joy that a human being gets to experience when he's walking this earth, I was feeling like I was missing something. Because that was like a huge part of my AA life. Thank God for good sponsorship. And a guy that's been up here to speak, his name's Vance. What an unbelievable example of dignity that he has been to me. But in conversations with him, he encouraged me to remain diligent in my prayer life and to like really get serious about the actions that Alcoholics Anonymous asks us to take when nobody's looking. So let me tell you what happens. About 9 months later, about 10 months later, my son was about 9 months old, sitting in my living room in Fishtown, and I see him take them two steps, and he falls on his face. And I had a certainty in my heart. I got to be there to see that. And what I realized that day watching that was you guys were missing something. That little shift in my heart, I didn't think it was going to happen. Because I had gotten so caught up in the fellowship of AA and I was missing a huge piece of the program. It's my belief that Alcoholics Anonymous is meant to be a bridge to life. It's not meant to be a bridge to Moray A. And believe me, when I say that, I am not taking shots at people that are very active members of AA. That's not my intention. But AA is here to give a guy like me an opportunity to be a better parent, a better husband, a better son, a better, just whatever I do in my life, I want to be a better person. And it wasn't until my son came along that I started to realize that. You know, but as a result of him showing up in my life, and it's probably been a year since I've been able to go to the same meeting back to back in two consecutive weeks. It's just difficult. You know, both my wife and I both work full time. Her schedule shifts, my schedule shifts. Ear infections show up, nasal infections show up. That dreaded stomach bug that tends to go through a school like a shows up a lot. But there's principles behind what Alcoholics Anonymous offers us. And there's the benefit that I get from being at my home group and talking to people outside and engaging with people, discussing what it is that we do here, can be engaged in anywhere I am. All I have to do is be willing to answer the phone. And when I look back over my life, AA and booze, they almost work the same way. When I was a kid, I needed a change in my perception. When I was 30 years old and I was homeless and I lived under a bridge, I would get up every morning and I'd think to myself, this is crazy. I can't believe I'm here. I want to kill myself. I'm homeless. I live under a bridge. I got the same clothes on. I don't have anywhere to call home. Like, this sucks. I don't want to live. I want to die. But then I get a couple in me. I'm under the same bridge. I'm in the same dirty clothes. I smell the same. And I'm looking around going, eh, this ain't so bad. So hold that up to how Alcoholics Anonymous works. My wife was about, I don't know, 6.5, 7 months pregnant. I was in my final semester of my bachelor degree at Temple University. It was December. At the time, I was not driving yet. I still hadn't got my license back, so I was like, you know, riding the bus. So I get up in the morning, I get dressed. I walk around to the Dunkin' Donuts, get that large turbo with an extra shot. And I'm waiting for the bus, and it's cold, and it's rainy, and I'm just like, man, it's warm back there where I just left. She's going to sleep till about 11. I can go climb back in bed with her and just chill. Did not want to be in my day. Wasn't really feeling going to school. Get on the bus, and I'm just like, you know, kind of melancholy. I'm just like, I got to go out of here again. And all of a sudden, it's my phone's vibrating in my pocket. And I pull it out, and it's my buddy Pat, who had just moved into a recovery house the night before. So, hey, Pat, how are you? And we talked for like 2 minutes. There was no deep therapy. It was just two guys talking. How are you? How's the recovery house? Anybody eat your tuna sandwich? Write your name on every stick of butter. You know, I was like teasing them. We talked for like 2 minutes, and I hung the phone up. But let me tell you something. The same experience. When I hung that phone up, I was just like, all right, I'm going to school. Like, it shipped up. My whole perception of the day had changed just from answering my phone. To me, that's the simplicity of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even though it's been a lot different for me over the last couple of years, it's still the same. I may not get to stand outside of my home group as often as I'd like, but a lot of those same people that I would be standing outside of my home talking to, I talk to at 10 after 10 at night or 7:30 in the morning when I'm on my way to work. So I want to thank you guys for the privilege to be able to come up and do this. And Alcoholics Anonymous just amazes me. There was a time in my life where no matter where I went, people would say things to me like, please, for the love of God, don't ever come back. And I think the coolest thing about AA, and especially in the kind of AA that I'm involved in, is you may not get to see people for a couple of years. Like, I got to see Rich tonight, who I haven't seen since the last time I was here. But then you get to see him outside, and it's like I just saw him last week. And you get to catch up for a minute. That's cool stuff. So it's really cool for me to be able to be a part of that. So again, I want to thank you guys for having me. Appreciate it.